Well, thanks for the invitation to be here. I always get very nervous when I find that I have to be in rush hour on 66. I break out in a cold sweat, but many of you do it daily, so it's probably nothing to you. What surprises me is the number of people in the HOV lane that only have one passenger. Not even a passenger, just the driver.
The dummy deflated. That was on the other seat.
I was tempted. Anyway, what I'd like to do is talk to you about a very special campaign, a campaign that is not as well known as it ought to be, quite frankly. And hopefully, now with the Susquecentennial and what Rob is doing and what your roundtable is doing, it'll get more recognition. I've written 10 books now. I have written quite a few books on Gettysburg. And then I got into map books. It started off with the maps of Gettysburg. And I realized when I was 13, 14 years old, and I had a real strong interest in the Civil War, but I couldn't quite understand what was going on in these battles. And as an adult, I still had trouble figuring out what happened in these battles because there's never enough maps. And everybody says the same thing, never enough maps. And so why not illustrate, and this is my life's work now, and I hope I can do it before I die, and I mean that sincerely, but every campaign in the Eastern Theater will have a map book. There's also been one on Chickamauga I didn't do. And for me, it's a matter of not only writing the text, but also preparing the maps. And what's neat is I can go back and forth and I can see just how they line up or don't line up. And so, first book was Maps of Gettysburg, and then I jumped over because of Susquecentennial to the Maps of First Bull Run. A couple years ago came out the Maps of Antietam, and I guess it was last year, actually. And then the one that's coming up now. Now, why did I pick this one? Bless you. I would have gotten to it eventually, obviously, the Susquecentennial. And I was really ambitious. The one I'm just finishing up now is on the maps of the Wilderness Campaign. And my hair used to be dark before I started this campaign because May 6th, it's worse than I had even thought it to be. What a mess in the thickets. Now, I'm going to start off with a disclaimer. I am not an expert on any of these campaigns. What I am is I've taken a lot of primary sources, secondary sources, and what I'm going to do is illustrate the campaign in a way that you probably haven't seen before. I'm going to use my interpretations because what I've learned along the way is things that you think are, this is the way it happened, are up for conjecture. And even especially when we get to Auburn, I know how many of you know John Pearson, but you know, he really opened my eyes because of a different perspective, and I actually used his perspective. And so it's not black and white. There's so much we don't know. And all we can do is take educated guesses on all of this. So let me go through this as expeditiously as I can. I think it's important that I start off with Gettysburg because obviously it was such a seminal campaign. When each army loses about 23,000 men, when Lee's army loses about a third and Meade's about 25%, obviously it's going to have a major impact after. Not only in terms of the enlisted men, but when you think about all of the officers, you know, from captains all the way up to major generals in the case of Hood or Reynolds. And as a result, there were morale problems, especially in Lee's army. A lot of desertions were occurring. And what you found was religion found its way into the camps, as well as Lee used some well-used furloughs. Now, he's hoping that these men would come back to the army, but at least they wouldn't desert to get home and visit. Both armies, a big major concern about horses. These horses were just worn out. Not only the cavalry horses, those that pulled the wagons, and especially the artillery horses were just about played out. Interesting in terms of the reputation. You would think Meade would be at the high point, but obviously after the he let Lee get away, and again, I do not second guess, but I don't think that it would have been wise, from my perspective, for him to try to attack Lee with Lee's back against the river. I think it would have been a bloody repulse, but anyway, Lincoln thought otherwise and was very anxious or did consider removing him from command. But how do you remove someone from command of the Army of the Potomac who had the only one who had beaten Lee? You can't do that. And Lee, just the opposite. You know, he was devastated by this defeat, really had never suffered anything like this before, and tendered his resignation to Jefferson Davis. And very wisely, Jefferson Davis said, no, this is not going to be accepted. Can you see the maps in the back? Hopefully? Okay. I wish I could say, pull out a book and you can look at it that way. Now, yes, is it possible to bring it down a little bit? Now, let me tell you also the way I use PowerPoints. I use PowerPoints not only to illustrate, but also I don't use notes. And so I have some cheat sheets in the left. And also I realize some of the elderly and not so elderly people may not hear as well as they used to. So they may miss something, and there it's going to be on the left. But as we have the end of July, remember, both armies are now back in Virginia. You have the Union Army is behind the Rappahannock River, and the Confederate Army is actually fairly well dispersed, with A.P. Hill's Corps and Longstreet's First Corps below Culpeper Courthouse, and Ewell is all the way up around Madison Courthouse. And forage, or at lack of adequate forage, was a major reason. Lee could not have all of his forces combined because there just was not enough food and resources for his men and for his horses, so he kept them separate at this time. We're going to see this happen, but one of the seminal areas that happens during the Bristow Station campaign is the armies are going to get smaller. They got smaller at Gettysburg. They continue to get smaller. You know, at one time, Jefferson Davis, before Gettysburg, after Gettysburg, wanted Lee to move to the Army of the Tennessee. And instead, they shoved over Longstreet's Corps on September 9th, just in time to actually help win the Battle of Chickamauga. The Union Army, a bit later, toward the end of the month, we're going to see, is also going to shrink in size as it loses two of its corps. Smaller corps, but still very important. Now, all through this campaign, and also the book not only does Bristow Station, it also does Mine Run. And it actually goes into February of 1864, and it covers Morton's Ford. But Mine Run was also, I could spend time talking about Mine Run. How many of you have been to the Payne's Farm battlefield? Not a lot of people have gotten there. Not a lot of people know about it. Ted Savis, who publishes this book, loves Mine Run and Payne's Farm. So I have about 13 maps on it, more than most of the actions of Gettysburg. But we have someone here, Mike Block, who's passionate about Rappahannock Station. So I go into that, I go into Kelly's Ford, etc. Lincoln all through is saying, okay, you didn't finish off Lee after Gettysburg. I want you to continue to go after him and to destroy him. And this is, you know, usually when the Union Army has been defeated, it's going to lick its wounds for a while, and it's usually Lee that's going to be taking the offensive. Well, not in this case. Meade was constantly badgered by Halleck and by Lincoln, and so finally he's going to mount an initiative, and this is going to be in mid-September, where he's going to cross the Rappahannock River, and he's going to proceed toward Culpeper Courthouse. A lot of actions, by the way, in August, in September, a lot of cavalry actions that are in the book. I'm not going to talk about those tonight. I just don't have enough time. But they're going to cross the Rappahannock River on September 14th, and they're basically going to get to their assigned positions about September 17th. At this time, we're talking about mid-September, Longstreet's Corps is gone. And Lee is going to pull back across the Rapidan River, as you can see, and he's going to build some very strong defensive breastworks because he's lost a third of his army, and he's already suffered tremendous losses at Gettysburg that have not been replenished. And so by mid-September, you're going to have then, the Union Army is moving up toward Culpeper, and you can see the Cavalry Corps, Kilpatrick's and Buford's divisions are moving toward the Rapidan River. Eventually, you can see they're going to turn, and the 2nd Corps is over here. You can see the 12th Corps. The 1st Corps is, they're all going to be moving toward the Rapidan River and to try to take on Lee's defenses. Lots of cavalry probes going on at this time, as I mentioned. Now, Meade was never happy about this position. He didn't like fighting here. He wanted to change his base of operations to Fredericksburg. And there was a constant barrage back and forth of asking to allow him to change his base of operations to Fredericksburg. And Lincoln and Halleck said, no, you stay exactly where you are. Why? Because Lee is here, and that's where they wanted him to be, to destroy or take on Lee. So Lincoln has a question toward the end of the month. And it's a good question, as you can see. If the enemy's 60,000 are sufficient to keep our 90,000 away from Richmond, why, by the same rule, may not 40,000 of ours keep their 60,000 away from Washington, leaving us 50,000 to put somewhere else? That's a reasonable question. Because at this point, what happened was, here's Meade, who has never been an offensive general, and he knows that Lee is across the Rapidan River, behind very strong breastworks. He doesn't want to touch that. And so Halleck writes a few days later, please answer if you have positively determined to make any immediate movement. If not, prepare the 11th and 12th Corps to be sent to Washington as soon as cars can be sent to you. And what does Meade say? I contemplate no immediate movement. And the cars came, and off went the 11th and 12th Corps, never to return. So both armies have gotten smaller by the end of September. Well, Meade isn't doing anything. And so Lee, even though he's been badly wounded, even though he's lost Longstreet's corps, he's going to take on the offensive. And this is the very beginning of October. And you can see, for instance, Ewell Hill, they're going to start making a circuitous move toward Orange Courthouse, and eventually they're going to concentrate at Madison Courthouse. And he's going to use the same tactics that he used at 2nd Manassas. Whoops. And that is, he's going to freeze the Union Army and then bring another force around its flank. Now, he used a wing at 2nd Manassas. He doesn't have that kind of force. And so he uses simply Fitz Lee's cavalry division and two infantry brigades, Johnston's and Walker's, less than probably 7,000-8,000 men. They are supposed to freeze the Union Army while they're demonstrating, while Lee is taking most of his infantry around the Union right flank. As you can see. And this movement is going to begin on October the 8th. Now, on the 10th, you can see that the Confederate troops are now around Madison Courthouse, and they're going to use two routes. Ewell's going to be coming down this way toward Griffinsburg. You're going to have A.P. Hill coming down and skirting Mitchell's Mountain. And eventually, they're all going to be linking up, but heading toward the Union right flank. Now, what was supposed to happen around this time is Buford's division had crossed the Rapidan River and was moving, as you can see, west, while the 1st Corps and the 6th Corps were supposed to cross at Morton's Ford and eventually drive away the Confederate forces here. Unfortunately, there are no Confederate forces there. But Meade finds out, whoops, the Confederate army is on the move, and he quickly aborts this plan And here's Meade. He can't tell Meade not to cross the Rapidan. And Meade is actually, Buford, thank you, has to fight his way across. He could have gone the way he came. He decided to cross Morton's Ford. And he had to fight Johnston's infantry brigade as well as elements of Fitz Lee's cavalry division to get across. He does, ultimately. Finally, Meade is going to decide, rather than try to defend this area, he's fairly well dispersed, and so probably the wisest thing he could do would be to retreat. And he's going to retreat basically the way he came, back across the Rappahannock River, and this is, as you can see, the evening of October 10th. He's moving backward. I'll get the hang of this yet. And he completes this movement on October the 11th. Now, Lee's been criticized because of very slow movements around this time. Movements of maybe 6 miles a day, in some cases 10. Not very aggressive, probably because he's determining what his next move would be. He's also not well. He's got more heart conditions. He's riding around in an ambulance. He's too weak to mount his horse. So Lee has options. Option one, remember, the Union Army is now safely across the Rappahannock River. Option one, he can go back across the Rapidan River to his old entrenchments. Is that what Lee is usually wanting to do? Option two, he can end the campaign. He can end the campaign and he remain where he is. No, he's not going to do that. He's going to continue the offensive. Why not? And so he's going to continue to head for the Union right flank. And the Union right flank, as you can see, at the area of White Sulphur Springs, you have Gregg's Cavalry Division is defending this area. And there's, obviously, you know, there's a bridge in this area. And there's going to be a small skirmish there. Eventually, Gregg is going to pull back. They're going to try to destroy the bridge, not able to destroy it. And this leaves the flank of the Union Army directly open. And here's the 11th Corps just sitting there, very vulnerable, that the Confederates could fall on the left flank and roll the army up. In fact, that evening, the 1st Brigade of Rodes' Division, Doles' Brigade, will cross at about 6 o'clock in the evening, and that's all that happens. Lee says, okay, that's enough. We're not going to pursue this. He didn't have a Stonewall Jackson. He didn't have a Longstreet. He had Ewell and A.P. Hill. So he decides to rest his men. Oh, it always does this. Okay, come on. Okay, good. Obviously, some additional cavalry actions. Another fight at Brandy Station, as you can see, where Young's Cavalry Brigade is up against Buford's division. Now, Meade doesn't know exactly where Lee is. He knows he's on the march. He doesn't know exactly where. And there are rumors that A.P. Hill's Corps has been sent west as well, and that this movement is only a demonstration. It's only to try to deceive Meade into thinking that Lee has most of his army intact. But he doesn't know that. And so he's going to send out a strong reconnaissance in force. He's going to send out the 6th Corps, the 5th Corps, the 2nd Corps. They're going to cross the Rappahannock River, and they're going to drive forward to see what they can find. But at 9 o'clock that night, he learns that, whoops, on my right flank is Robert E. Lee. Not a good place for Robert E. Lee to be. And so he quickly aborts the reconnaissance, and these troops quickly come back across the river. Okay, so what's he going to do? Remember, this is not an aggressive general. And his best option for him is to continue the retreat. He's not going to turn. He's not going to fight. He's going to continue to move his army toward Bull Run, to get as back as far as he can from Lee's army. And he's going to be in two columns. One column is the Third Corps and the Second Corps. It's going to march through Auburn. It's going to go to Greenwich, and eventually head on toward Milford. And then the rest of his army is going to follow the Orange and Alexandria Railroad, and eventually they're going to make their way toward Bull Run. Meanwhile, Ewell and Hill are making their way toward Warrenton, and we've got a little problem here, as you may know, because Wade Hampton's, remember, he's been wounded at Gettysburg, and Stuart is commanding his division, and they get themselves caught between these two wings, and he's stuck. So he dresses about six of his men in Union outfits, and he sends them, and each one of them is successful in getting through the Union lines, and they get to Robert E. Lee to say, hey, we need help. We're stuck. We can be annihilated here. And Lee is going to then quickly send Ewell in that direction, and we'll see what happens at the Battle of Auburn. This is one, as I've mentioned, is one where there's a lot of conjecture, because some actions or some accounts will have the Confederate Army coming along Dumfries Road. But I believe, and I'm following what Mr. Pearson, John Pearson, has suggested, and I think all the evidence shows this, as you're going to see, that the Confederate Army, Ewell's corps was coming up this way through Double Poplar Road. Anyway, so here we have Stuart hiding in the woods here. The Third Corps has already passed, and very quietly they've tried to quiet the mules, they've tried to quiet the men so they would not be seen. As I mentioned, the Third Corps passed that night before on the 13th, and now the Second Corps, the rear guard of this column, is marching very quickly along Rogues Road. Thank you. Can't see it. Rogues Road. There it is, right there. I need new glasses. Caldwell's division is in the lead. You have Hayes's division behind it. In between are all the wagon trains, and then you have Webb's division bringing up the rear. Okay. Meanwhile, you have Rhodes's division coming up with a cavalry screen on Double Poplar Road, and you can see that Greg's cavalry division was screening the movement. They knew the Confederates were coming into from this area, and they've got portions of the 10th New York Cavalry Regiment out as a screen here. And what's going to happen then is Caldwell's division is going to cross Cedar Run, and it's going to climb a hill that had no name, as you know. It soon becomes Coffee Hill after the men start brewing their coffee. Well, Stuart, ever vigilant, sees what's happening. He sees all of these Union troops just resting, making coffee, having breakfast on this hill, and he's going to then bring out Beckham's 7 guns, and he's going to deploy them on high ground where it's a very, very easy shot for them to really cause havoc to the Union troops. And he opens fire. And he opens fire because he heard a skirmish occurring between the 10th New York and Lomax's troopers. But it was too premature. The Rhodes' men were nowhere near providing the support that Stewart's going to need. He's got two brigades. He's got, as I mentioned, seven guns. He probably has about 2,000 men, maybe 2,500 men. That's about it. Well, this was not a good idea. Because you got Ames, you've got Ricketts, and they are facing this way. Well, they're going to swivel those guns, and immediately they're going to rain death on Beckham's guns. In the meantime, you can see that Owen's brigade, which is crossed, is going to start moving toward Beckham's guns, and we'll see this in the next slide. Meanwhile, they Governor Warren, who's commanding the Second Corps, becomes aware of the fact that Ewell's corps is moving toward a very vulnerable part of his position, and he's going to send a couple brigades, Kelly's Irish Brigade, he's going to send Carroll's Brigade to try to block this movement while he can get his wagons and the rest of his men to the safety of St. Andrew's Church Road. The Confederates are deploying now. Rhodes is in position. Early is going to move across country to Dumfries Road, and Johnson's going to move his division, and he's going to be in the middle. Lots of artillery are going to deploy in this area. But one of the things that is very clear from the combatants is the movements are very slow and they're very methodical. There's no hurry on the part of these Confederates to take on the Second Corps that is in a very vulnerable spot because it's straddling Cedar Run and very much open to annihilation. Anyway, so you can see the 125th New York is moving very rapidly toward Beckham's guns. Beckham is going to pull back before they're captured. And the rest of Owen's brigade is going to head toward Wade Hampton's division. And they're going to need to get away, but they can't. They're just too close. And so they'd send the 1st North Carolina Cavalry Regiment in a suicide charge against Owen's infantry. The commander, Thomas Ruffin, is mortally wounded. Many of the men go down, but they buy time for Stuart to get his troopers away. But it was not the way that Stuart thought that this action was going to be was going to happen. The wagons are finally across, as you can see, by 10 o'clock. And because most of the infantry now are safely across Cedar Run, the rest of the Union infantry are going to start pulling back. And you can see Rhodes is slowly coming forward, Johnson's coming forward. And you're going to have a rearguard action right here between some of Early's men and Brooks's brigade, but it really doesn't amount to much. So basically, here we had a golden opportunity for Ewell's corps to, if not destroy, severely damage the Second Corps, and they got away.
Can you ask a question?
Sure.
What kind of criticism does Ewell get into because of the slow movement? Was he on the field? Was he watching this?
He was on the field, yes. Ewell had a reputation for being slow. And actually, in the book I'm writing on the wilderness, he did quite well in a defensive mode. And ultimately, he's going to be removed command because he doesn't have the aggression that Lee demands and needs. So, yeah, and you're going to see we have extremes. We're going to have a slow-moving Ewell, and we're going to see a highly aggressive, overly aggressive AP Hill. And both come in under criticism for that reason. Stuart is not happy. This is his report. Strange to say, the fire of our infantry ceased as soon as it opened with Beckham's guns. A vigorous attack on Main Body would have ensured the annihilation. Well, that's kind of hyperbole. But I think they would have damaged them. I think they could have if they had moved quickly. But no one seems to have been wanting to move quickly at this time. Okay, So are we ready for Bristow? Okay, I'm going to go through this fairly quickly. So again, it's still October 14th. You can see, well, let me get some of these. AP Hill is supposed to break camp at midnight, and these orders are countermanded, and instead he's to start his march at 5 o'clock. And one of our more recent historians say this change of time would have a critical impact on the course of events for the day, and that's probably an understatement. Both Ewell and Hill are going to reach Greenwich at about the same time, and you're going to have AP Hill is going to be moving first, but his entire corps is not involved. You have the lead division was Anderson's. Anderson's division, it's going to be thrown toward Buckland because there's a report of some wagons, some infantry in that area. So guess who leads AP Hill's corps? Henry Heath, reminiscent of Gettysburg. A lot of reminiscent about Gettysburg. Followed by Wilcox's was Pender's division. There's going to be a rearguard action with the Third Corps, fairly minor. But Meade now, he sees that most of his army is moving nicely, but the last unit is that Second Corps, and he's really worried about that Second Corps. They got about 11,000, sometimes you see 8,000 infantry, 26 pieces of artillery, about 150 ambulances and wagons, and they're making their way slowly. Question?
Doctor, why did AP Hill head toward Greenwich instead of going right up the Warrington Turnpike, where he would collide with Ewell?
I believe that those were his orders, you know, from Lee, to move in that direction. That's the only thing I can think of at this point. So here's the two commanders at Bristow. Governor Warren, hero of Gettysburg, on the right, and probably the... Do we have any strong AP Hill supporters here? Okay, I'll be nice. And we have AP Hill, who didn't do so well at Gettysburg. I'll leave it at that.
I still like him.
Yes, he was a very nice man, and he did try his best. You have to give that to him. And so, the Fifth Corps... under General Sykes, is supposed to hang around Broad Run, waiting for the Second Corps, providing support for the Second Corps. He's not supposed to move until he sees the Second Corps arrive. And Sykes is not a very gallant soldier. He's getting nervous himself. He waits until 1 o'clock. He doesn't know what's going on at Auburn. He didn't know that there was that action. And so at 1 o'clock, he says, I'm not waiting anymore. I'm getting out of here. And about this time, AP Hill is going to arrive between 1:30 and 2 o'clock, and they're going to see portions of the Fifth Corps that are crossing Broad Run. And he's going to quickly deploy for action, reminiscent of Gettysburg. There's no cavalry involved. There's no screening. There's no reconnaissance. It's Henry Heath in the very beginning. And the Second Corps is marching along, as you can see, and it's going to be interesting. We're going to have two major brigades, in Confederate brigades, involved in this charge at Bristow Station. John Cook, whose brigade was not at Gettysburg and therefore fairly large, and William Kirkland, who commanded Pettigrew's brigade, which was fairly well decimated at Gettysburg. Henry Walker's brigade, Brockenbrough's old brigade, you know, not the most gallant group of men, not well led, fairly well demoralized, and Davis's brigade in reserve. Okay, and so AP Hill is ordered to cross Broad Run after these Yankees, they don't know exactly who they are, after the Yanks. And so Kirkland and Cook are going to deploy for action. And they do it so quickly. Actually, Cook does it first and starts moving forward. Kirkland is a little bit behind him. Walker's supposed to form over here on the left, but they're moving forward toward Broad Run even before he has a chance to deploy. And here it starts. General Cook says, you know, we've got some problems here. I'm seeing some Yankees to my right, and this doesn't feel right. And what does Heath do? He does something that's different from Gettysburg. He learned. He halts the advance, and he goes back and he talks to A.P. Hill. He says, what do you want me to do? And A.P. Hill basically says, keep going. Anderson's division is on its way. You continue the advance after those Yanks. So in the lead is Webb's division, followed by Hayes, followed by Caldwell's division. They're going to send out the 1st Minnesota. And the 1st Minnesota is going to move toward the right flank of Cook's brigade. As you can see, it's going to come toward the 46th North Carolina. The commander of the 46th North Carolina says, I discovered the enemy line of battle behind a railroad extending as far as I could see. So he's looking over, and he's starting to see all of these Yankees behind this railroad embankment. Federal surgeon, who's on the Union line, obviously. Through the lifting mist, we dimly saw another column marching parallel to ours. We were supposed to be one from our own corps. Both columns stopped and stared in amazement at each other. And Hill orders the advance toward Broad Run. Again, no cavalry screen. Now, this is just like a Gettysburg, just like the Pickett, Pettigrew, and Trimble charge. It was really the artillery that blasted the charge apart. Same thing's going to happen here. First unit that's going to come tearing across, in fact, it's going to disrupt Owen's brigade, is Brown's brigade. Brown's battery, and Brown had a distinguished role during that major charge at Gettysburg. They're going to create a space where they can shoot through, and they're going to start to fire at these North Carolinians that are heading toward Broad Run. Now they're going to see the danger to the right. The Yanks have already continued, of the 5th Corps, excuse me, have moved off, and you have them starting to wheel. Cook has a lesser wheel. Kirkland has a greater wheel, but they're going to wheel to the right to face the 2nd Corps. And where's Walker? Walker doesn't see anything. So he's moving, he's actually in the woods, and he's continuing to march his men toward Broad Run. As, at the same time, you can see that, thank you, appreciate it. You see that Warren's men are continuing to march. In fact, they actually cross one unit, the 82nd New York, actually is going to cross Broad Run. And then Warren arrives, and he says, whoa, we cannot be continuing to march while it looks like we're going to be under attack. So he pulls them back, and he's going to form a line along the embankment. Heath's brigade is on the right. Mallon's brigade is on the left. And you can see all of the Federal artillery taking position. Anderson's division still has not arrived yet. It's on its way, but it's still... So you're going to have these two Confederate brigades are going to be attacking what could be a full Union corps. 4,000, approximately, North Carolinians. They complete their wheel at about 2:45. At the same time, Owen's brigade is moving in position behind the railroad embankment. And if you take all of these, you've got about 7,000 men, 16 artillery pieces, and they're all behind an embankment, several rows deep. Walker doesn't know what's going on. He literally crosses Broad Run. He's out of the action totally. And eventually says, whoa, I'm not supposed to be here, and crosses back, but too late to play any role. Lots of obstacles, Rob, and all of you know this. You know, the terrain, it's great in terms of maintaining your line of battle. fairly open. It's not as long a distance as what Pickett's men and Pettigrew's men had to march. Some protection, but right in front, except for a few huts and the like, fairly well open. And the railroad cut, you know, a wonderful defensive position, except on the middle of Mallon's line that crossed the road where there was no cut at all. And imagine you were a member, a North Carolinian, from Kirkland's command. You've done this before, not that long ago. Do you really want to do this again? Well, they did it. to their credit, they tried it. Help is starting to arrive. Perry's Floridians and Posey's Mississippians are arriving, taking position. They're not going to be in time for this major attack. David McIntosh's battalion is galloping into position. So we have some support. A.P. Hill actually positions the artillery. And McIntosh is very unhappy. It's too close to the Union line. It's too vulnerable. He knows his men are going to be decimated. And Hill doesn't want to hear anything about it. Look at the artillery, if you will. We have Ricketts. We have Brown. We have Arnold. At this point, more are coming up. This is where most of the losses are going to be occurring at this time. Some quotes from the 44th North Carolina. You can read this as well as I. Here dashed a Federal battery, another appeared, and so others. A bugle sounded, and a mad race began beyond the railroad embankment. We raced, men swore and yelled, now see and hear the shriek and crack of the shells and the thud of shot. One actually exploded in the middle of his Kirkland's line, took out about 15 men. Colonel Hall, the musketry fire from the line railroad was very heavy. I soon saw that a rapid advance must be made or withdraw. I chose the former. And this was later on in the advance. Federal artillerymen, we paid no attention to the artillery. They didn't care about McIntosh. Though their shells were making wild music in their mix, they cared just like a Pickett's charge. They wanted the infantry, and that's what they got. General Warren, a more inspiring scene could not be imagined. The enemy's line of battle, boldly moving forward, one part of our own steadily awaiting it, and another moving against it at the double quick, while the artillery was taking up position at a gallop and going into action. And so here they are, moving forward, as you can see, against this very formidable Union line of defense. The Union soldiers were basically told to hold their fire until the Confederates got closer. For the most part, most of them did. Some of them could not and fired. And it's hard to imagine just the number of men that were stacked in the railroad cut, ready to open fire. And when they opened fire, suddenly the order fire rang along our lines. The devastation was indescribable. Hundreds of Confederates dropped, others bewildered, rushed back, some forward, while our fellows with a wild cheer fired volley after volley into them. No man seemed left to be standing. It's hard to imagine the devastation. It appears that Cook's men did get further. The 27th North Carolina probably got further than any of the others. And it was slaughter. What's interesting is the 42nd North Carolina is right where the road bisects the railroad cut. It's where there's no protective embankment, and these men are starting to run in the wrong direction as the Confederates are coming closer to them. Colonel Mallon, recently married, runs over, tries to rally them. Is hit, I believe, in the stomach. I think it's a gut wound, if I'm not mistaken. Dies a few days later. But ultimately, he's able to rally the troops and hold. The greatest danger is right here on the right flank, when you can see a couple of Confederate regiments, the 11th North Carolina and part of, what is that, the 52nd, is going to enfilade the line, actually flank it. But there's a problem. And the problem is right here. Brown's artillery. You also have Ricketts' artillery. And you have the 82nd New York that's still firing into it, and eventually they're just not able to make any headway, and they're forced to pull back. Smith's brigade is now on the scene, and it's moving forward, and it's going to be going toward the flank of Cook's brigade. You can see the 46th North Carolina is going to refuse its flank, and it's going to try to defend the rest of the brigade as you have this new group of Union forces coming toward them. I mean, it's chaos. It's hard to imagine the hell that was here this particular day. The North Carolinians are retreating. Some of them are surrendering. Interesting, the 15th was an interesting unit. Apparently, their commander formed two lines. The first line would be firing, and the second line would be retreating, and then they would change positions, and eventually they were able to pull back in a more organized fashion. When they get back, you can imagine how they feel when they can see the rest of their division just sort of hanging around while they're being slaughtered. McIntosh, while these troops are pulling back, has not been given orders or is not permitted to withdraw. He goes over to A.P. Hill, and he's been asking them. And this quote is from McIntosh. Cook's men were falling back through the guns. My officers joined me in endeavoring to rally and stop them upon the slope, but without avail. So here you're going to have these vulnerable Confederate guns just sitting there. And they're not even firing, because most of the cannoneers, the horses, they're all down by this point. And along in a skirmish line is going to be the 1st Minnesota and the 19th Massachusetts, and they're going to be approaching the guns. And eventually they're going to capture at least five of them and pull them to safety. You know, usually when you lose one gun, that's a big thing, but to lose five guns, that was really hurtful for McIntosh. Smith's brigade is going to continue its advance. In this case, it's going to try to prevent these guns from being recaptured. And they run into Perry's and Posey's brigades. And you're going to have an action right here. It doesn't really amount to much. Smith says a rebel line then made its appearance about 400 yards from my line. Their line of battle moving a little diagonally to mine, as you can see. Between 4 and 5 o'clock, nothing. It all is quiet. It all stops. And during this time, reinforcements are arriving. Caldwell is now in position. You can see how Carroll's brigade is refused to protect the flank. You can see that Ewell's men are now coming into position. You have Gregg's cavalry division, bless you, which probably saved the Second Corps, and I'll explain this in just a little bit. An additional, look at all of this artillery that has deployed now. And even on the Confederate side, quite a bit of artillery. So Ewell arrives, and he confers with Lee, he confers with Hill, and they all agree, and it makes perfect sense. We want you to be aligned right here, perpendicular to those railroad tracks. And you're going to charge and you're going to roll up the flank, just like, remember Gordon, on the evening of the 6th of May, or Searle, earlier on in the morning, the same thing could happen. But what happens, though, it doesn't. Because Gregg's cavalry are guarding a bridge over Kettle Run. John Gordon, sees them without orders, apparently, orders his men across Kettle Run after the cavalry. Okay? So he's basically taken his men out of the action. Now, Jubal Early, any Jubal Early lovers here or supporters here? Okay. You know, he had his moments. This wasn't one of them. And so Early does nothing. He says, this is from his official report, that Gordon was more than one-third of my division, and with the other brigades, I was not strong enough to advance against the enemy position, especially there was a very dense thicket of young pines which rendered an advance in line impossible. So rather than attacking, he's going to move forward, and he's going to form on Anderson's right flank, basically. John Caldwell, in his report, very interesting. Late in the afternoon, a very heavy column moved to my left and partly crossed the track. This is early. But for some unexplained reason, did not attack with their infantry. He was shocked because he was vulnerable. He could have been rolled up. Now, around this time, Lee has about 40,000 men. How many did we say that Warren has? About 11,000 or so. And so, what an opportunity. And what happens? Nothing. Inaction. And finally, Warren orders the march very quiet. They're going to stifle their cannons, and they're going to march as quietly as they can. Leaving at about 9 o'clock, they're going to continue the march by the flank across Bristow Station and continuing across Broad Run, etc. And as one soldier said, in ghastly silence, the army was a steal away. They completed the entire crossing by about midnight, and they continued to march all night to find safety. Losses were horrendous, as you can imagine. Kirkland's men lost about 40% of their strength. Cook lost more men, but because he had more, he lost almost 30% of his men in a fruitless charge. The 27th North Carolina of Cook's brigade lost 70% of their men. Perry, you know, the tangled with Smith, lost 24. Posey lost 7. They lost 1,331 men for nothing. Two flags were lost. Three brigade commanders, both Kirkland, Cook, and Posey, were wounded. And actually, Posey, they thought it was a flesh wound, became infected and died. Lost 5 cannon. I mean, horrendous losses. Union side, Heath's brigade, 72 men. Mallins, 59. Owen, 125. Smith, 68. 324. Now, Hill, you know, Robert E. Lee was a gentleman, and usually he didn't rebuke his subordinates unless he was really upset with you. He usually would just send you away from the army. And so here he is riding around the battlefield. It's about 6:30, and Jed Hotchkiss, the map maker, observes the two interacting, and he says, there seemed to be a great deal of bitter feelings in what Lee said to General Hill. One of the men who saw Hill later on said Hill rode away from the meeting seemingly very worried. The next morning, the Union Army, the Second Corps, is gone. And there are many variations of this, but you've heard this. Lee to A.P. Hill, well, General, bury these dead men, or these poor men, and let us say no more about it. Mm-hmm. And apparently Hill said, it's my fault, you know, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have done this. And Lee snaps, saying, yes, it's your fault. You committed a great blunder yesterday. Your line of battle was too short, yes. It was too thin, yes. And your reserves were too far away, yes. And weren't deployed. Richmond newspapers, a woeful blunder, they called A.P. Hill, who was guilty of, quote, an unpardonable mismanagement. And in Hill's report, I'm convinced that I made the attack too hastily. He actually admits it. But if he had, but there's always the but, right? If I had delayed, there would have been no enemy to attack. In that event, I believe I would have been equally blamed myself for not attacking at once. He lost almost 1,400 men for really nothing, for mismanagement. And so that's just an overview. Hopefully you get a better feel for the campaign, you know, by seeing it illustrated in maps. So if there's a few questions, yes.
Can you go back to the last of your map slides and show us where the park is today?
Okay, actually I should have...
How much of that is encompassed in the park or how much is not?
I'm going to actually defer to Rob on that.
Basically all of Cook's...
I don't know if I can get back there. Can you roll that down? Oh, no, it's, over.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you cancel that. Yeah, cancel that.
There you go.
And if you just roll down here.
No, get out of style.
Almost there.
No.
Now, let's see what I can. Oh, you doing it? Okay. Okay. Rob? I know when to call on the troops, the experts.
Where you have Cook's Brigade from McIntosh's artillery down and a little bit of Smith's position, that's the park today.
Yeah.
So, probably the left flank of Smith is off park property, but the right flank is on, and the entire Cook's Brigade is on park property with McIntosh's position as well.
And the railroad cut itself and south of that is
private property.
Private property. Mm-hmm.
A very active railroad, and if you ever touch it, they will come quickly and tell you it's private.
Ah.
Homeland Security.
Interesting.
Where's the housing development? On the
behind the guns. Yeah,
very
right.
Cozy.
Right behind the guns, essentially?
Yeah, just essentially behind the guns. I'll say about 200 yards behind the guns.
Behind McIntosh's?
Yes, sir.
Yes.
Can you show us again where the point of contact was between Posey and Smith?
Sure. Let's see if I can find that. There it is, right there.
Is that, that's on private land, right?
No,
it's
in the house.
It's in the house.
Yes.
Earlier in your presentation, you mentioned that Lee and Hill moving out at, wanted them to move out at midnight, but they moved out at 5:30. How did that play into the battle? Can you explain that to me?
Sure. What may have happened is that A.P. Hill may have had more of his forces in position to take on the Second Corps. So if he was already in that area, you know, right now he was already spread out pretty much. And Anderson's division was not up. Wilcox's division was not up. If those divisions had been up, they could have intercepted the Second Corps. And
so if they had started at midnight,
right.
They would have
yes,
been up.
That's right.
Started by
mm-hmm. And as someone mentioned, and it's so interesting that the differences between Ewell, very cautious. Imagine if A.P. Hill was at Auburn. You know, that may have been very different. You know, and it may not have been it wouldn't have been a frontal charge at that point. I see some other hands. Yes.
What day was the Auburn fight?
Also on the 14th of October. It was just earlier in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, sorry, I should have made that clear. Yes.
Who was Johnson?
Johnson, Edward Johnson, old Allegheny, yes. So he did not play, as you can see, much of a role. At Payne's Farm, he's going to play a big role. Did not do much here during this particular engagement. Yes, in the back there?
Yeah. Sunset was about 6 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
They're marching in the pitch black.
I don't know if it was.
What's the guidepost?
I don't know if it's pitch black at that point. It's getting darker. But you're talking in terms of Lee and Hill?
Yeah, they said, what can I march until 4 in the morning? What were their guideposts? What were their...
They're marching along the railroad. So that's the guidepost. You know, if they're marching on the railroad, they're in good shape. If they're stumbling along the fields, they're going to have some problems.
Yeah. They just are fighting after dark, but that's very unusual.
Well, you take the Wilderness Campaign. You know, where Gordon's attack actually happened at dusk, and most of the fighting is occurring at 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock at night. You know, and in fact, it's going on till 10 at night. So you're right, most fighting does not occur after dark, but sometimes it does. Yes?
Was the railroad operational, or was it, had it been
deep? Oh, no, it certainly was operational. It was very, very important, especially for the Union forces. And one of the things that happens is the Confederates are going to destroy big chunks of it. And this is going to have it's interesting. Meade is, one of the excuses Meade's going to have in launching an offensive is because Meade has destroyed so much of the railroad. But they're able to dispatch so many workers to repair it, they repair it within a few weeks. So Meade couldn't use that as an excuse any longer.
What rebuke did Meade get for his actions here?
It was ongoing. In fact, periodically, Lincoln